namely a booster that will increase and optimize their protection.
More U.S. booster vaccines. It's Tuesday, October 26th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Chris Cascio in Washington. Find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, resettling Afghan refugees. Israel welcomes Indian immigrants. Data security worries. Climate change adaptable frogs. Squid Game's wide appeal. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Millions of people in the United States are gearing up to get COVID-19 booster shots amid ongoing controversy over vaccine mandates. VOA's Michelle Quinn reports.
With 77% of Americans having received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, people are talking about what they should do next. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has approved booster shots to some extent for all three approved vaccines, Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, and Pfizer. For the booster, the CDC says people can pick a different shot than the one they received, essentially mixing and matching vaccines. Dr. Anthony Fauci is the White House's chief medical advisor. He spoke on ABC this week.
That allows a considerable degree of flexibility for people to get what we hope they will get, namely a booster that will increase and optimize their protection.
This week, health officials will meet to discuss Pfizer's report that its vaccine is safe and effective for children ages 5 to 11, setting up the possibility that inoculations for them may start in early November. News of boosters and the possible vaccination of children comes as a little more than 22% of adults in the U.S. have yet to receive a single dose. Employers continue to roll out vaccination mandates. American Airlines says its employees must submit proof of vaccination by the end of November or face being fired. New York is offering city employees who haven't been vaccinated $500 for their first dose, but promising consequences for those who refuse. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio.
If not, as we saw with healthcare, with education, you get a letter that says on November 1st, you're going to go on leave without pay. We don't want that for anyone. We just want to get people vaccinated.
The New York City Police Union said the decision to be vaccinated was a personal medical decision, and it would seek legal action to protect members' rights. Vaccine mandates remain controversial, with 58% of Americans saying in a recent Hill-Harris X poll that the directives are helping the battle against COVID-19. 24% say mandates are hurting. That divide is similar when it comes to whether the mandates are helping the economy, with 51% saying the policies help, and 35% say they hurt. How the U.S. handles the pandemic in coming months will likely have a political fallout. In addition to the pandemic, Americans are worried about the economy, inflation, and supply chain issues. In recent weeks, President Joe Biden's approval rating has slipped, averaging 43%. Michelle Quinn, VOA News.
Find more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the VOAnews.com website. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. China to vaccinate children age 3 and up as cases spread. Amnesty International to close Hong Kong offices. Evergrande says it has resumed work on 10 stalled projects. UN says nearly 23 million Afghans face acute hunger. Uzbekistan's incumbent leader wins second term in office. Full coverage on all these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and on the VOAnews.com website. Thank you for listening to VOA Asia on this Tuesday. More than 50,000 Afghan refugees who are now housed at U.S. military bases will be resettled throughout the United States in coming months. The largest number will be heading for California and Texas. As VOA's Mike O'Sullivan reports, the Afghan-American community and local officials are getting ready.
Afghan-Americans in California protest what they call the Taliban government's repressive and cruel behavior during separate rallies in San Diego and Los Angeles in August and September. Now they're preparing for the arrival of Afghan refugees. One aid worker says the refugees are relieved to have fled a country led by the Taliban. Fayez Nawabi is policy and advocacy manager for the Council on American-Islamic Relations, California.
They're also very thankful that America was able to accept them, and then also that the Amemsa community, the Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, South Asian community, worked really hard to pool resources to help these individuals find housing, to help pay for basic necessities.
One Afghan-American who worked as an interpreter for U.S. forces resettled in the U.S. with a special immigrant visa in late 2012. He's helping to store supplies for newcomers, but also worries about Afghans left behind. Former U.S. interpreter Lutfullah Saadet.
People are losing their lives. Taliban are searching. They are saying one thing but doing another thing.
Saadet says dozens of his family members are living in fear in Afghanistan, including a brother who once worked for U.S. forces. Millions of Afghans have fled war in the country over the last 40 years. The UN Refugee Agency says 90% of those refugees now live in Iran and Pakistan. Saadet says the U.S. and its allies must help those who helped them and pressure the Taliban to respect human rights. Former interpreter and Afghan refugee Lutfullah Saadet.
The solution should be that how should we make sure that the Taliban has a good government, a very inclusive government that represents all of the race and ethnicities in Afghanistan, not just from one tribe, not just from one political party.
California will receive more than 5,000 Afghan refugees in the first group. Some communities are asking for federal help and for locals to step up too. San Diego County Supervisor Joel Anderson.
All these folks need placement, and it makes sense that they're placed with people that speak the same language that can help them immigrate.
Afghan Americans are not optimistic about the future of their homeland, but still hope for change, says Fayez Nawabi.
We want to see an Afghanistan that is free, an Afghanistan that is peaceful, an Afghanistan that believes in human rights for all people.
In the meantime, tens of thousands of Afghan refugees will join others who have built a better life in America. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Still to come on VOA Asia, immigrants from northeastern India arrive in Israel to start their new lives. Happening now in Asia, as of Monday, Tokyo restaurants no longer face alcohol bans or restricted business hours because new COVID-19 cases in the city have plummeted from a mid-August high of nearly 6,000. The Japanese capital reported 19 new cases on Sunday. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Continuing now on VOA Asia, Israel recently welcomed the arrival of another group of immigrants from northeastern India. Believed to be descendants of one of the lost tribes of Israel, for 2,700 years they have followed Jewish practices. Linda Gradstein reports.
The latest group of B'nai Menashe, or children of Menashe, arrived in Israel earlier this month. They trace their ancestry back to one of the 10 lost tribes of Israel, the tribe of Menashe. At the airport, Israel's immigration absorption minister, herself an immigrant from Ethiopia, welcomed them.
We'll continue working to unite all the families and to make them feel at home here. There are always challenges, but we'll do whatever we can to help and integrate you the same way we were integrated.
The B'nai Menashe were brought to Israel by Shavei Israel, a nonprofit organization dedicated to finding lost tribes and bringing them as immigrants to Israel.
Throughout their sojourn in exile, the B'nai Menashe continued to practice a biblical form of Judaism. They kept the Sabbath, they kept kosher, they celebrated the festivals, they observed the laws of family purity, and they also nourished a yearning to return to the land of Israel.
During more than 10 years, Shavei Israel has brought 5,000 B'nai Menashe to Israel, with another 6,500 still waiting in India to emigrate. While they keep kosher and observe the Sabbath, they are not recognized as Jews by the Israeli rabbinic establishment. They must officially convert to Israel after they arrive and remarry in an Orthodox Jewish ceremony. One of these B'nai Menashe couples, Devorah and Avihu Haukip, were married 5 years ago in India, but had a second group wedding ceremony in Israel.
As soon as we landed in Israel, we did a conversion and a second marriage, because while we were in India, we had not yet converted. So we moved up spiritually as well as physically.
Devorah Haukip says moving to Israel has been a dream come true.
When I heard about the news, I'm really excited and happy. I've been waiting for this to come true since my childhood, I should say.
The Haukips are among some 1,000 B'nai Menashe who moved to this town in the Galilee, Nof HaGalil, 10 months ago. They are all studying in an intensive Hebrew course to prepare them to fully enter into Israeli society. The integration of lost Jewish tribes like the B'nai Menashe is a fundamental principle of Zionism, says Shavei Israel's director.
Last week, when they emerged from the plane and walked down the steps, many of them got down on the ground, recited the Shehechianu blessing, a blessing that we say at moments of great joy to thank God, and then proceeded to kiss the tarmac, to kiss the ground, because they were so moved.
Shavei Israel hopes to bring the entire community, as well as other lost tribes, to Israel over the next few years. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Nof HaGalil in northern Israel.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. Chinese President Xi Jinping and Belgium's King Philippe on Monday exchanged congratulatory messages on the 50th anniversary of bilateral diplomatic ties. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, Chinese companies like Huawei and the Transsion Group are responsible for much of the digital infrastructure and smartphones used in Africa. Chinese phones built in Africa come with already installed apps for mobile money transfer services that increase the reach of Chinese tech companies. But while many Africans may find the availability of such technology useful, the trend worries some experts in data management. Mohamed Yusuf has more from Nairobi.
China has taken the lead in the development of Africa's artificial intelligence and communication infrastructure. In July 2020, Cameroon contracted with Huawei, a Chinese telecommunication infrastructure company, to equip government data centers. In 2019, Kenya was reported to have signed the same company to deliver smart city and surveillance technology worth $174 million. A study by the Atlantic Council found that Huawei has developed 30% of the 3G network and 70% of the 4G network in Africa. Eric Olander is a managing editor of the Chinese Africa Project, a media organization examining China's engagement in Africa. He says Chinese investment is helping Africa grow.
The networking equipment is really what's so vital. And what the Chinese have been able to do, specifically Huawei in particular, is they bring the networking, you know, infrastructure together with state-backed loans. And that's the combination that has proven to be very effective. So a lot of governments that would not be able to afford 4G and 5G network upgrades are able to get these concessional loans from the China Exim Bank that are used then to purchase Huawei equipment.
Data compiled by the Australian Strategy Policy Institute, a Canberra-based defense and policy research organization, show China has built 266 technology projects in Africa, ranging from the 4G and 5G telecommunications networks to data centers, smart city projects that modernize urban centers, and education programs. While the new technology has helped modernize the African continent, some say it comes at a cost that is not measured in dollars. China loaned the Ethiopian government more than $3 billion to be used to upgrade its digital infrastructure. Critics say the money helped Ethiopia expand its authoritarian rule and monitor telecom network users. According to an investigation by the Wall Street Journal, Huawei technology helped the Ugandan and Zambian government spy on government critics. In 2019, Uganda procured millions of dollars in closed-circuit television surveillance technology from Huawei, ostensibly to help control urban crime. Police in the East African nation admitted to using the system's facial recognition ability supplied by Huawei to arrest more than 800 opposition supporters last year. Bulelani Jili is a cybersecurity fellow at the Belfer Center at Harvard University. He says African citizens must be made aware of the risk in relations with Chinese tech companies.
There needs to be greater public awareness and attention to this issue, in part because it's a kind of a key metric surrounding both developments, but also both kind of Africa-China relations going forward. We should also be thinking about data sovereignty is going to be kind of a key factor going forward.
Jili says data sharing will create more challenges for relations between Africa and China.
The kind of security questions about data, and specifically how is it managed, who owns it, and how can governments that depend on private actors to provide them the technical capacities to initiate certain state services.
London-based organization Privacy International says at least 24 African countries have laws that protect the personal data of their citizens, but experts say most of those laws are not enforced. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Making headlines in Asia, China reported 39 new COVID-19 cases on Monday, bringing the tally from the latest Delta variant-linked outbreak to more than 100 cases over the past week. Authorities are determined to halt the latest outbreak with the Winter Olympics a little more than 100 days away. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. For the first time in a laboratory, Australian scientists have produced tadpoles more tolerant of climate change. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Researchers in Australia want to give nature a helping hand. They've warned that climate change poses an enormous threat to many of the world's frogs. Genetic traits that allow a type of amphibian called a crawling frog to survive in regions with lower rainfall, researchers say, could be passed on through breeding. They've mixed frogs from drier parts of southwestern Australia with others from wetter areas. Sperm and eggs from four different crawling frog populations that occur in areas with various levels of rainfall were used in the experiment. The effort produced tadpoles that were better adapted to climate change and had increased tolerance to dry conditions. The world's first laboratory trial has been reported in the journal Communications Biology. Jodie Rowley is a lead scientist at the Australian Museum Citizen Science Project and an expert in amphibians. She believes that frogs need help to meet the challenges of global warming.
It does seem a little bit like we're acting God in some ways, but I think at this point it's some of the only ways that we're going to be able to have these amazing frogs in the future. The times of just leaving things alone to be protected in these areas is not going to work anymore. You know, climate change is moving faster than the frogs are able to adapt themselves. So we're going to have to do things like potentially move animals from one place to the other, or in this case, give them a little genetic advantage to allow them to be able to persist in this new world that they're going to be living in.
The University of Western Australia team said that more trials would be needed before these crossbreeding techniques could be applied in the wild to reduce the risk of species extinctions. Rainfall in southwestern Australia has declined in the past 40 years, and it's a trend that's expected to continue. The project to boost the climate resilience of crawling frogs was part of research by the Australian Government's Conservation Initiative, Threatened Species Recovery Hub. It's examined ways to help at-risk species adapt to climate change. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
Finally on VOA Asia, the South Korean television show Squid Game has become Netflix's biggest series launch ever, topping 111 million viewers globally. Karina Bafrajan examines the phenomenon of the Squid Game.
Since the mid-September release of the South Korean series Squid Game on Netflix, over 132 million people around the world have started watching the show, according to Bloomberg. No other Netflix project has become so popular so quickly. The 9-episode series is about a world where children's games turn deadly. People who are deeply in debt play to win a giant cash prize, but in these games, the loser dies. Despite its dark content, the show was an instant hit.
Squid Game comes out. Some people discover it. It's in some people's queues. That's that. Then it starts becoming huge. Then every late night talk show host is talking about it. Pretty soon, everybody at work or on your Zoom call is talking about it. The idea that it really taps into something we can all identify with, or many of us can identify with, which is the idea of being on the edge of an economic disaster. And then the way they handle it.
It's a relatively new thing for Americans to enthusiastically embrace a foreign TV show.
For so long, I mean, Americans were really known for almost their stubborn, aggressive adherence to not consuming product made in another country. We exported all of our movies and our music and our TV shows, but very few things came the other way. But I think we've been slowly but surely kind of training the ugly American attitude towards this stuff.
Squid Game isn't just a hit in the U.S. and South Korea. It's a worldwide hit. One Beijing cafe, for example, holds workshops for those willing to make sugar cookies, just like the ones in the show.
I watched the show and I thought it was very interesting. I was especially impressed by the episode with the cookies. There are a lot of young people among our customers who also love the show. So we decided to give them a chance to make those cookies themselves.
And in Moscow, visitors to a Korean cafe chain can play a game involving sugar cookies similar to the one in the show. They need to, using only a needle, carve a particular shape on top of the cookie without crumbling it.
My task is to keep an eye on the people. If they lose, I need to bring them their punishment. In our case, it's pepper. We also keep an eye on time. We only give 10 minutes per game. So we make sure each player has only 10 minutes.
It's still unclear whether there will be a second season of Squid Game. Neither the show creators nor Netflix representatives have made any statements yet. But since Netflix's profits for the show reached about $900 million, it seems to make sense, at least financially. Karina Befredjian for VOA News, Washington.
That's all the time we have on VOA Asia. Make sure to find us on Facebook, VOA Asia, on Twitter at VOA Asia, and on Instagram, YouTube, and at voanews.com. Thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Keith Lane, Amy Hybels, and Jessica Stone. I'm Chris Cascale in Washington. Enjoy the day.